on the line now, I have Edward Brennan. I was talking to you last week. Good morning to you, Edward.
No, how are you?
How are you? Just to continue our discussion. Just remind people what you're about the history of nationalist nationalist history of television in Ireland.
Yeah, well, I've written a book which is in production. It'll be out shortly, and it's called A Post-Nationalist History of Television in Ireland. So the reason it's called a post-nationalist history is that what I'm arguing is that the methods that have been used to date have used state archives, the RTE archives, newspaper articles and so on, to create a picture of television in Ireland. But in effect, what those methods have really done is just tell us about the history of Irish television. So we've learned a lot about RTE and so on, but it hasn't really looked at the medium of television and how it arrived in Ireland. And so what I'm trying to do is get away from that kind of inevitably, sort of unintentionally, but nonetheless effectively nationalist approach, and look at other approaches to learn about television. So what I've done is I've combined other sources, newspaper sources, academic sources and so on, with people's memories of television. And what I found is that when you listen to people's memories about television, you get a very different picture of how people use television and how television arrived in Ireland and shaped people's lives. Mm-hmm. So that's the gist of what I'm at, essentially.
Okay, I'm just thinking, Edward, the weekly thing, I can't remember what it's called, believe it or not, you know, it gives you the year and that sort of thing. It's sort of like a bit of history of news at that particular year.
Reading in the years.
That's it, yeah. So it's not that type of thing that you're talking about at all, because even though it's sort of talking about a specific year, it's still depicting what was shown and the influences and the terror sometimes and the good things and whatever the music at the time. But it is a sort of a skewed version of television, isn't it, when you think about it like that?
Yeah, I think reeling in the years is fascinating, and it's one of those things that if I had more time myself, I'd love to look at it in a kind of an organised, systematic sort of way, you know. Because I suppose what's really interesting about it is, and this is part of what I'm concerned with in the book, is that, you know, media shape our view of the world to an extent, but they also shape our view of the past. And so this is what's really important, is that there's kind of a competition going on, if you like, for shaping how the past is understood. And I wouldn't want to hazard an opinion on how reading in the years represented, but nonetheless, there is this question about, you know, are there certain events that are foregrounded and maybe other events that recede into the background? You know, is there kind of almost like an editorial, and it's not just about reading in the years, it's about any number of programs, is there almost an editorial approach to the past? And then the other thing, and this is part of what I'm saying in the book, is that it's not about people even having conscious intentions about how they shape the past. Quite often, if you depend on something like an archive, your decisions can be made for you in terms of what material is available. There's also questions like what material do you think the audience will engage with, and that kind of thing. You know, so sometimes just the processes that we use can shape our views of the past. So what I've done is try to use a slightly different process in writing this book, and hopefully then that gives rise to a kind of a, I wouldn't say an alternative view, but a complementary view to round out the history that we have, you know?
Yeah, and you wonder about some of the things, just I don't want to go too much into reading in the years, but I've heard some comments from people watching it and saying, Christ, the more things change, the more they stay the same, especially in politics, to the extent over the years and the way things have happened. And then other reflections are when you think about the housing crisis and the health and how things weren't so bad maybe back then, whereas sometimes we're accused of being sentimental, thinking back to good old days. But really, when you think about it, hospitals at every corner and houses being built all over the place, I suppose that's a reflection as well. You get all these sort of little spy holes into the past and sort of get a chance to reflect on the difference and how it reverberates today, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose there is that question about how, you know, an awful lot of patterns in politics sort of repeat themselves. I suppose what I've been interested in is not really, it's kind of to back away from that sort of very controversial.
Okay. I know. Yeah.
Not really my.
Well, how do you think? Okay, Edward. How do you think about? I think we talked a bit about it last week. Influences of British television, for instance, which more or less, I think, was in Ireland and indeed American programs. When you talk about television as a whole, it was 1960, 61 before Irish television came into being. But you're talking about television in general, so that would have to include British and American.
Oh, and inevitably, yeah. And what I'm saying then, in terms of, like, not to avoid your question, but in terms of that question about, you know, saying about backing away from the controversial question of, you know, are things better or worse, it's obviously there's cases where things are dramatically better, and then there may be areas where things have disimproved and so on. But the thing I'm interested in is not so much in history repeating itself as the sort of the long-term process that has happened. And I think a large part of that, and television is a central part of it, is where life has become more privatized, more individualized, and at the same time, more globalized. And I think that's one of the key effects of television. That's one of the television didn't cause that, but it was part of a bigger process that brought about this different way of living, you know. And so I think that's one of the key changes. And that's the kind of transformation that's taken for granted and that you won't see in reading in the years, because it happened almost invisibly. You know, it happened over a very, very long period of time. And it's a bit like mobile phones, smartphones today. Now we get to the point where we don't know what we'd do without them. And yet we've only had them really in effect about 10 years. So when things change, when there's this sort of sea change, it becomes the new normal. And we find it difficult to remember or imagine what we did before. So I think they're the kind of cultural transformations that I'm interested in, which you won't read about in the newspapers, and you won't see discussed as part of political change and so on, you know. But to answer your question about... But the thing about British television, as you say, I mean, the earliest recollections of television that people shared with me involved the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in 1953 and this kind of thing, you know. So like, the earliest television in Ireland was British. So, like, the earliest television viewing, as opposed to broadcasting, in Ireland was inevitably British. And so people remember the coronation, and I think I might have said it to you, you know, but there was a bit of controversy, obviously, about the coronation. There's a story about a guy who smashed a television set in a pub on Marlborough Street on the day of the coronation in protest. There was various controversies around it and so on. But some people do recall that as sort of an occasion, you know. A lot of Irish people as well would have seen the coronation not in Ireland, but in Britain instead. So people recall being part of London street parties and that kind of thing. So for a lot of Irish people were familiar with television, but they developed their familiarity with television in Britain or in a smaller number of cases in America. And then I think that British television sort of seamlessly became part of the Irish experience of television. So in the first year of RTE, half of Irish television households also had access to BBC and UTV or ITV. So British programmes were always there. And like I was saying to you last week, you know, it's a bit like the cup of tea, you know, that it seems like this very Irish thing, although it's not at all. That I think particularly programmes like Match of the Day, Coronation Street, Top of the Pops, and so on, just became part of the kind of background wallpaper in Ireland, as just part of life in Ireland.
And it hasn't.
Although they were very much.
And it hasn't changed. It hasn't changed that part of it. I mean, the two programs you mentioned, Match of the Day in particular, that hasn't changed really. I know the television, like phones, have advanced so much in over the years. But the appetite for such things hasn't changed. I have a son comes home from Madrid at Christmas and during the summer, and he watches Match of the Day every Saturday stuff like that, you know. Where you were talking about the dramatic changes in the phones over the years, that it's so commonplace now that older people, even in their 40s, are finding it hard to catch up. Because, I mean, I find myself, and I'm well pensionable, and I find myself when I'm listening to something on the radio, if I missed it, I want to be able to rewind it, the same as you do with the television. Yeah. So this sort of conditioning gets into your head with everything, no matter what it is, you know.
Yeah. I had a bizarre experience a long time ago when I was using a computer a lot, and I found myself reading a newspaper one day and looking up into the corner of the page to see what time it was, because I've become so used to looking at the screen that you do. These kind of habits become ingrained, you know.
Mm.
So and they become ingrained very quickly, and they become accepted as normal, I think, very quickly. And so that's part of the interesting thing, you know.
Okay. So some of the things you wanted to concentrate on this week on talking about Edward.
Well, I just thought that what was interesting is if you look at the way newspapers talked about television in the 50s and early 60s, it's very interesting because it tells us about the attitudes that emerged around television. And I think it probably shaped people's experience of television. So I think there was a lot of stuff in the paper about, if you like, a kind of a moral panic or a hopes and fears kind of discussion, you know, that people were full of optimism about the great changes, the great positive changes that television would bring. And then equally, there was an awful lot of negativity about the destructive influence of television. And I think the destructive influence was concerned with the family particularly. And the other thing is that what emerged when you look at the papers is that, and I think this is still important with phones and so on, that an element of snobbery was present. And that the element of snobbery started off with a concern about education and the well-being of the family. But very quickly you could see that it was about a sort of a class-based snobbery, and that television was bound up with ideas about class, people's social class, and their level of cultural distinction, if you like.
Yeah.
And so these ideas emerged through the press. And it seems to me that the way existing media talk about new media shapes the way we experience them and use them, you know. So I suppose if you look, it might be the case if you look at the internet in the past 30 years, that the way the newspapers and the way television talked about the internet shapes the way we understand the internet, the way we use it, what we take it to be, and so on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the thing, really, that I suppose this hopes and fears idea, you know, that like with you know, the De Valera quote about atomic power, where De Valera on the opening night of RTE in his opening speech compares television with atomic power in its capacity to do good or evil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with this?
Oh yeah, I think it's the same. You could apply that to the internet today. The old saying, like, for instance, like movies and critics and television, no matter what it is, word of mouth can do all the damage or do all the good either way. And our internet now, social media, is the new word of mouth to an extent, isn't it? As regards newspapers, television and cinema, everything.
I suppose it is. It's kind of, to digress for a second, it's kind of, it's a little worrying, I suppose, in the way people take the internet to be word of mouth, because if somebody says something to you face to face, you know exactly who's saying it, when they're saying it, what context they're saying it in, and so on. And I suppose the worry about the internet with social media is that it is mediated, and that you'll see opinions and so on. But in the meantime, there's algorithms working in the background that are selecting which opinions, which ideas should be of more interest to you, which ideas will cause more engagement, and so on. So I take your point that it serves the role of word of mouth, but at the same time, it's being selected in the background.
Without
people's knowledge.
Yeah, it can turn into Chinese whispers as well. I'm wondering about the influence the way the influences between church, state, and indeed the media itself, paper media on television, the way maybe they've lost a little bit of their power over the many, many years, especially the church and in politics and government and dictating what's moral and what isn't and that sort of thing over the years.
Yeah.
In the papers as well as on TV, how do you think that has changed? For good or bad?
I think that the key transformation, and I think we talked about it last week, is that a key transformation that happened in Ireland from the late 50s and early 60s was an economic transformation where the church, a sociologist from UCD called Tom Inglis wrote about this, where the church, the power of the church was not just bound up with people's concern about their immortal soul and so on, but that to get on in life, to be well connected, to have any sort of political career, to run a successful business and so on, you had to be seen to be a good Catholic. That the church was very much sewn into the economy. And that from the 60s onwards, particularly with foreign firms, mainly American multinationals coming in, a new set of possibilities emerged around the economy where somebody could be quite well respected in their work, could be quite well to do and so on, and have nothing to do with the church because the new economic system was quite separate from the church and the ideas that the church had put in place. And the state as well began to separate in its policies from the church. So we mentioned the bishop and the knighty last week. But one of the things that's commonly overlooked with the bishop and the knighty is that there was a big row going on between a bishop in Galway and the Minister for Education week before the bishop and the knighty emerged. And this was around the closure of rural schools and so on, which the bishop had objected to. And so the priority of government became around changing the educational system towards vocational skills and so on, away from the model preferred by the church. So there was the beginnings of a rift there. But undoubtedly, television has kind of accelerated that divide. And media played a huge role in the decline of the power of the church, particularly the early 90s, with the scandals that emerged and so on. So media has inevitably been part of that decline.
Okay.
And that social transformation.
In the compilation of the book, Edward, how long did it take you? Obviously, you're still sort of editing and that sort of thing. How long did it take you?
Oh, well, all told, I think it took about 4 years. I mean, like thankfully, my role now is finished, that I'm done with editing and so on, and hopefully it's just gone into, it's going into print with Palgrave Macmillan, they're an academic publisher.
Mm-hmm.
So, my role is largely done. It was a big enough piece of work, and I suppose there was a lot of ideas to be worked out and so on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just to mention about the religious aspect, you know.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
In the newspapers in the 50s, there was a lot of warnings from the Pope, warnings from various Protestant clergy and so on, about the dangers of television. And it was all very much couched in that kind of hopes and fears narrative, that they always would recognise the positive potential of television, but then also the dangers of television in terms of affecting family life and causing disillusion and so on. So there were a number of warnings that were kind of constantly popping up in the newspapers. There were concerns about education, concerns about social class, and there were also these religious concerns as well. So I suppose being a very heavy viewer of television was not seen to be something that was compatible with a pious or religious way of life.
Yeah, you don't see the influence. I mean, in the early days, I don't mean the influence, but you don't see as much religion on TV as you would have in the early days, especially on Irish television. And I suppose even on British television, when you think about it, I don't think they have as many religious programmes as they used to as well in the 60s and 70s, and even coming into the 80s. So things have changed, I suppose, in that respect. Just as a matter of interest with your book, Edward, we're talking about the speed of technology and that, and over the 4 years, did you feel like things were happening quite fast and you might have to tweak a bit here and there on it while you were doing the editing?
I suppose the thing with academic work now is that there is just so much material being produced all the time that you almost become fatalistic about keeping on top of it, that you do your best.
Yes, yeah.
And that new material, new ideas coming out all the time, but that there's just such a torrent of material that you almost have to be at peace with the fact that you just won't cover everything, you know. Mm-hmm. And thankfully as well, since it was historical, it wasn't like trying to write something about the internet today where there's new developments and new transformations happening every week, you know, that mm-hmm. the stuff constantly changing, you know.
Okay. Sorry, when will you expect it to be out and for people to get, and how can you tell us about that? How can people get their hands on it?
All going well, I would hope it would be out about March, April. I think that the first edition of it will be hardback. I suspect it'll be quite expensive, which is unfortunately the way with academic books.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be available in hopefully college libraries and public libraries. So in local libraries around the city, perhaps. So that might be a way to get it. And the other thing is that chapters will also be available online. So that'll be probably the there'll be a launch and so on, hopefully in around April, as I say. But hopefully in libraries like the ILEC Centre and all the various local libraries, there should be copies accessible.
Yeah, it's a thing I'd like to see myself, and I'm sure a lot of people in academia, maybe on the curriculum in schools as well, for young people to get a history of television in Ireland from the Irish perspective, as you have done here. And, you know, would you be pushing it for that as well? Because I think that would be a great idea.
I think there's an awful lot of there's quite a bit of media history already on.
But not as specific as this, Edward. I don't think it's specific as this, though.
Yeah, I think this, if you like, is a kind of a further questioning of the ideas that are already quite dominant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that the history of television in Ireland is really about the history of Irish television, it tries to go beyond that and say that, like, if we really want to understand the influence of television, we have to consider British television, we have to consider people watching the Lone Ranger, in the 50s, the Westerns, things like The Fugitive, which is like this huge event kind of television, mm-hmm. and so on, that these are part of Irish, the history of television in Ireland too, you know, and people kind of tend to overlook them. And you know, it may be anecdotal, but certainly people talking about how they feel that there was a decline in community, which was not caused by television, but that mm-hmm. television was part of it. That television simply made it easier to stay home and be entertained at home, and people had less need of their neighbours for a sense of company and for news and for a bit of crack or whatever.
Yeah.
So these are all really important transformations, but they're in the history that exists, they're kind of passed over as being just taken for granted.
And I think Edward, I think as well there was a lot of subtle subliminal influences in society without sometimes us realising it, whether it was fashion or sometimes some of the phrases we would use. I won't quote them now, but I remember quite a few of them that came out purely from American TV. That's it. And we didn't realise the way we were talking. And I suppose it's still happening today.
Well, of course. I mean, remember, and it's not American television, remember Stop the Lights, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's true. That was our own influence. But that didn't travel, though. Yeah. That didn't travel, Edward.
But there's so many phrases, you know, that the language people use and so on, and stock phrases that come from, like, Kojak or whatever the case may be, you know.
Who loves your baby, yeah.
This kind of thing, you know. Yeah. So that media become a really important part of the way people describe things, the phrases people use, you know, partially maybe the way people see the world as well, you know.
Okay, well, anyway, listen, we've run out of time, I'm afraid. I have to go up to a break, and I've really enjoyed talking to you over the past couple of weeks. People look up your website to get an idea of all of this and when it's due out and where it can be had?
Yeah, I've had a couple of conference papers in the area already, and they're available through Arrow on DIT. It's an online repository where people can access academic research within DIT for free. It's all open source Creative Commons content, so they can download papers there. And if people are interested as well, they can contact me if they're interested in the work. Maybe they can contact. I could give you an email address if that's.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Wherever is of guy for you.
Yeah, I've got a fairly basic website, but I'll be adding some extra material. But it's eddiebrennan.com, and there's a contact page on that, and they can drop me a line, and I'll get back to them if they might want a paper or some details or whatever, and I can send. I'd be happy to send people on past papers and so on that will provide some more detail on the work.
Okay, and the book is going to be A Post-Nationalist History of Television in Ireland. Is that the title, the official title of it, Edward? Okay. Listen, thank you very much for talking to us here in the FM. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. I look forward to going through the book as well.
No, thanks very much.
Every bits of it. Thanks very much. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye. That was Edward Brennan, and the book coming out March or April, as he was saying there. It's in post-production, but it's called A Post-Nationalist History of Television in Ireland. Sounds fantastic. I've read a couple of bits of chapters in that, and it's really fascinating to read. You just want to sit down and study it.